In the U.S., we refer to it as ping pong. Table tennis. Everywhere else in the world, it's table tennis. So we finally figured that out. Like, oh, yes, table tennis, the back and forth. And it made sense. But context matters. We're going to talk about that. When there is a space between the world in which you live and the person who's communicating and the person that's receiving the communication, things can get lost in translation. So we're going to talk about what that all means, how that applies to Genesis 1 and 2. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonad, and Adonai Echad. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Does anybody remember what I just said that word for here is in Hebrew? Shema, you've got it. All right, don't be shy. Shema, so it can mean to hear. But it can also mean to obey. So in Exodus 19:5, now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice, if you will shema. So in order to shema, in order to hear, we have to put things into action. So that's part of what it means to be a good hearer of the text, to be a good recipient of God's words, that we put things into actions. And I always say, so the Judeo faith is the roots of the Judeo-Christian faith. Like, that is where our roots are. What is interesting when you go back and look, there is something that demarcated Judaism almost from every other worldview on offer of the day. And primarily it is this: that the Jewish faith and worldview was not one of sight, but of sound. Not one of seeing, but of hearing. Not one of taking the images in that we see with our eyes and making sense of things, but hearing and following the voice of God. And thus, the Shema. And so we're going to figure out, how do we become good listeners of the ancient text? And so there's an old saying that the Bible, while it was written for us, it was not written to us. It was written to a different place, a different people, in a different time in history. So we want to pay attention to that. And when we do that hard work of figuring out, well, what would they have heard? Sometimes you'll hear, have you ever heard the phrase, the plain things are the main things, and the main things are the plain things? Anybody heard that? It's quite common in Protestantism. Your first question should be, plain to whom? Because what might be plain to you and I living in the 21st century would have not been what was plain and clear to those living much earlier than us who first received the text, and vice versa. So we want to make sure, what was plain to the original audience? What was the authorial intent of the person who was writing it? So just another text I didn't do, but in Deuteronomy 4, where he says, you know, you heard sounds, you didn't see sights. So that's why we want to pay attention to listening with our ears. We'll get to that in a minute. So we're going to get into this thing, and I want to talk about how I'm approaching Scripture. So all of Scripture is God-breathed, right? Did God write it? No? God inspired it. Who wrote it? People. So God inspired people to write. And so we want to say, how do we cooperate with these inspired authors? So, have you ever thought about, because I think we make Bible interpretation just overly complicated. Have you ever thought about what's necessary for communication to work? Like, how is it that you and I can actually talk and hopefully have a meaningful conversation? Like, what are some things we need for an act of communication to be successful? Can you guys think of anything? You need to be a language. So even language is already, it's like some kind of medium or vehicle from which the communication has to go forth through. So it can be language, it can be the spoken word, it can be written word. We could use sign language, right? Now, what if I go, well, we'll talk about that in a second. So anything else for communication to work? You have to be hear or see, so you have to have some kind of shared environment. But somebody has to send the communication. So you need somebody who sends it and somebody who receives it. So if we were talking in signals, what if I go like this? What did I just say? Steal second, maybe. You guys don't know? Why don't you know? What? No, we don't do that kind of language. It's not an agreed upon medium. So for language especially to work, we have to have a certain degree of cooperation. We use words that we have already agreed upon their meaning, used within their context. And if we're going to change that, we're going to assume that we have mastered the language enough to be able to use them in a different way. So there has to be this cooperation. I'm using the words in the way that we use them. And every word has a range of meaning, right? So it can mean several different things. Let me ask you this question. How was the course? If you overheard somebody saying, how was the course? How would you know what they're talking about? You need to know the context. So are they walking out of a classroom in college? What if it's a chef after a 7-course meal? What if it's somebody speaking to Roy McElroy? Could be golf. What if you're in the physical education classroom and all these cones and mats and all are set up? All sorts of different courses. What's that? Courses.
Degree of sandpaper.
Yes, yes. There you go. How coarse is it? So we want to know who said it, to whom were they speaking, and what was the situation or the occasion for how it was when it was said. So that's the same thing as we want to ask the scripture. We want to know who wrote it, to whom was it first written, and what was the occasion on which it was written. And part of how communication works is, see, our worlds, and this is what went wrong in Zimbabwe, they overlap. And it's our overlap that allows us to have shared meaning. And to the degrees we have different worlds, things can get lost in translation. So I'll give you one. My wife and I were laughing about this yesterday. We were driving out to Washington for a soccer game, and we saw this huge billboard for the party store. Anybody here from Michigan or up north? Do you know what a party store is up there? What's a party store here? Supplies for a party. So I'm up in Michigan, and my wife and I are dating, and my father-in-law says, let's go to the party store. I'm like, well, that's kind of odd. What are we going to do, get some balloons and streamers, or what are we doing? Up north, the party store is not the party store it is here in St. Louis. It's the liquor store. So if you're going to the party store, it's something quite different. So things get lost in translation, all different language up there. You know, things about youpers and trolls, if you lived under the bridge, all this kind of stuff. So that's the same thing that happened in Zimbabwe. So we want to pay attention to the shared world. And that's the world that we want to move into in the ancient Near East. So that's part of how we're going to approach the text. And it's a literary writing, but I want to approach Genesis 1 and 2 as a literary art form. So think about, let's do this. And thanks for hanging with me. I promise I will tie this all together. Since we were speaking about, let's see, Michigan and up north. This here is it's a picture of a painting. It's a painting that's in my wife's house that she grew up in. That's my wife, and she's sitting on a swing. What do you notice about this painting?
Water.
There's water, right?
That's what I thought, too.
What about what?
She only has one leg.
Oh, yeah. That you kind of there's a shadow there. Yeah, she's one-legged. You can't see the tree that's supporting her, the branch. So what do you think? That swing's just hanging out of midair?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Until it's proved.
Until it's proved? All right. Yeah, that tree is not there on that beach, and that swing is not there on that beach. This was taken, this is by an artist, Sherry Petrie, in Pentwater, Michigan, that did some drawings for my wife's family. This swing does exist. It is just more inland. This beach does exist. My wife does exist, and she does have two legs. So the artist here took some liberties in arranging the details of putting my wife. She took a picture of her in a swing inland and put it on the beach where she played with a young child. So if we think about literary art, we want to ask questions about things such as referentiality. So is this piece of art, if it's referential, does it point to a reality outside itself? Like, is it these things that actually exist? Is it being true to its purpose of what it wanted to capture? So this artist wanted to capture something in my wife's childhood. Do you think the artist did that? I think so. Because the details are rearranged and there's not a swing hanging out of the air on the beach, does that mean that we have to throw the whole painting out? No, okay. So keep that in mind. Now when you're painting something of, so like this, like you could say when it comes to referentiality, is this like just a, is this a particular, did this actually flower exist, or is it just a general representation of a flower? We don't know. We'd have to know the artist, right? But you can do that. But I'm going to argue that we're going to talk about things that actually have a reference to them, that actually have something that they're trying to depict. Let's see if I can do this one. So when you're an artist, you have to make a lot of different decisions, don't you? Like if you're going to capture something, what are some decisions you'd have to make it as an artist if you're going to do a painting of something that really exists? It's got to be accurate. Are you going to be accurate? So what are some of your options if you're not going to be accurate?
Well, you can make people look better than they are.
Okay, so you can change some things. Different sense, different setting. So you can take artistic liberties depending on what your purpose is. All right. Maybe you have to decide what details you're going to include, which details you're going to exclude. You can't include everything, right? That would just be a mess. You have to choose your vantage point. From which angle are you going to tell the story? Anything else you can think of?
Lighting,
time of day, all these different things.
The kind of mixture you're going to use?
Right. Right. So this is a picture of a Middle Eastern man and in a painting. Do you notice any differences?
Yeah.
What do you notice?
The tassel with a tassel on his forehead. I'm not sure what that is. Versus the other.
Right.
One is excluded, the other one's kept.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Clothing's different.
Yep.
What do you think the artist was after? Do you notice anything? Does anything draw your attention, your focus point in the painting?
The eyes.
Yeah?
It looks like he's got tears in the painting.
All right, talk to me more. So it looks like he has tears in the painting.
Yeah, it's very emotional.
Very emotional. Bingo. Obviously another therapist. This painted by a therapist, namely my wife. And that's exactly what she was doing. She was exploring the emotions of the eyes. Is he angry? Is he fearful? So there's some things that are left out and they look different. But for her intended purpose and what she wanted to do, is this a picture of a real man? Yes, even though it's not exact to the details of the man, but it's still something that's true, that there's a reference point behind that. Okay, very good. I'll do one last one. So this is a picture of a building. So for a while I was a pastor for quite a few years at a church down in Chesterfield Valley called The Crossing, and so I had one of these paintings that somebody had given me of part of the Porta Cove that goes out of it. But then here is more of an architectural rendering. These are different. Do they both have a historical reference, something that really exists? Yes. What do you think some of the differences are in these? One's technical, one's visual. So there's a different aim, there's a different purpose here. Does that mean that one's wrong or we can't trust it for anything? It depends on what you want to do, right? If you want to build, you want to go up here. Maybe if you want to invite somebody or celebrate some of the aesthetically pleasing features of the architecture, you'd use something more like this. All right? So now what I want to suggest is that Genesis 1 is a work of art. It's a literary work of art. So instead of using a paintbrush and pictures like that, the artist, who I'm going to argue is Moses, uses words. And so with that, some of these same things that we've said about these paintings and pictures, we can apply to the text. That the artist had to pick which details to include, which details to leave out. Because I don't know about you, but it's like Genesis 1 and 2 tells us about the world the way it was before sin, and how we're supposed to live in it, what we're meant for. It's like two chapters, that's it, really? That doesn't tell us much. Actually, there's a lot packed in there. We're going to find out about that. But it's like, I would like more than that. So it's what the scholars will call it's laconic in nature. So it doesn't tell us everything we want to know. Well, what was there before there was nothing? So there's a sense in which we're on a need-to-know basis. So that's part of the details. The vantage point. Which person is it told in? The arrangement of the details. Could the artist have taken some liberties with the way things are arranged? With the days, for example. Would that detract from the truthfulness any more than my wife having a picture of her hanging on a swing on the beach? So we're asking the questions. Or could they not? So it's going to be, we have to, based on the literary intent of the author. So we want to ask these sorts of questions, and we'll get into how that all plays out. And let me do one more thing about interpretation. I want to suggest that you guys are already experts at interpreting the Bible, because you're already experts at interpreting one another, and then we'll get more into some of the text and stuff. Oftentimes what I will hear is, I want to interpret the scripture in context. So often what I'll hear is, well, you have to interpret things literally for it to be true. We don't even do that in everyday life. God doesn't do that in his word. He uses idioms. He uses anthropomorphisms of his bowels rumbling. Does God's bowels really rumble? No, God is spirit. But it uses this language of him. And interpret things literally. What about Matthew 5, 28 through 30? If your right hand sins, cut it off. If your eyes cause you to sin, pluck one out. I haven't seen many Christians walking around one-handed or with one eye. Have you? All right, so we want to interpret things in their context. And so how you, in order to say something true and refer to something historical doesn't mean necessarily we have to say it literally. I can say things all the time, and I do, that are still true without using literal language. So this morning, if I got up and I said to my wife, oh, wow, Sam, it's raining cats and dogs outside. And she ran outside, and she expects to see calicos and Irish setters coming down from the sky. And she doesn't see it. So what does she conclude? Oh, my goodness, I married a liar. Had I known that, maybe I would have thought differently about things. But she doesn't do that. Why not? She knows my intent. I was using a different kind of speech. Literally, I said there are cats and dogs coming out of the sky. But the genre of that literature, just like there's different genres of paintings, was using an idiom, probably going back to the days when cats and dogs were in barns and the rafters would get wet and they'd fall down. And so because of that, what did I state? Simply, I was stating that there's a heavy downpour. So she can test my truth claim of saying, oh, that's either true or false. But if she tested whether or not there's cats and dogs coming out of the sky, she would arrive at a wrong conclusion. So she needs to pay attention to, and we always do this, what the person actually said. So we're talking about different genres. And we'll ask what kind of genre is Genesis 1 and 2. What about if I went up and said, hey, man, did anybody see the sunset last night? Would you all go like, gosh, that guy doesn't believe in the Copernican Revolution? The sun doesn't really set? Duh. Things... Why not? Because you already made an interpretive decision super fast in your head, knowing that, you know what? And even if you didn't think about it, you just automatically do it because we live in a shared world of, you know what he was using? Phenomenological language. Language of describing the phenomenon from the way he's experiencing and his vantage point. And we can do that. That is fine because that's the language. I wasn't trying to be scientific. I was trying to explain an experience. Let's think another one. What if I say, my love is a rose? You're like, wow. Chlorophyll? She must need a lot of sunlight. Why not? Probably because I'm being poetic and I might be employing metaphor, simile, analogy. And let's think of one more that we could use. I'm trying to think of another one. Anybody got something? Oh, I know. So we want to signal things. We signal the kind of speech that we use. What if I said, once upon a time? What story would you expect to follow? A fairy tale. Something that's not true. But I can also change things up, because sometimes I'll say to my daughter, once upon a time, there was a young man and a young woman who met each other. And I'll tell the story of how Sam and I met and how God has orchestrated things just in his holy, wise, providential care and how that matters for her too. So anyways, we can use language in different ways, but there's different signals in the text. And I'm going to argue that there's all kinds of different signals in Genesis 1 and 2 that sort of tells us, is it more like this? Is it more like that? Is it somewhere in between? And we want to get at what it means to be good readers of the text by incorporating with the inspired author and the authorial intent of the person who wrote it. So let's get into a little bit of asking our questions. Are you guys following so far? Does that make any sense? A little bit? All right. So I won't spend a lot of time on this because I don't think this is a group that, in a lot of liberal seminaries right now, they still teach what's called the documentary hypothesis. Anybody heard of that? J-E-D-P. Four different sources, and Moses wrote did not a word. It was written very late, post-exilic, after Israel's out of exile, and there's all these different sources, and they just compiled this whole thing together. That's why you see different names for God used in Genesis 1 and 2 and all this kind of, I'm going to call it, it's nonsense. So if nobody's adhering to that, I won't go into it. I have videos. If you guys want to get emails, and you can go through and I dissect those things and say, here's why I believe that Moses is actually the implied and author of the first five books of the Bible. So I'm going to take Moses as the first five books. And some of that is in Exodus like 7:14, Moses was commanded to write these words. So you have that. He makes a record of things in Numbers 33, which some other things. 36 times in Leviticus, you hear, see Moses, and Moses is, God said to Moses, and he's recording all these different things. A big thing for me is the profile. So if you look at the first five books of the Bible, it's somebody who was thoroughly Hebrew, but yet had intimate knowledge of Egyptian culture, Egyptian words, and Egyptian geography. And like, who else in history could have known Hebrew and done the Egyptian context as well? So there's a scholar by the name of Abraham Yehuda, and he has said, if you go through, and I've read some of his work, and you look at the language of the first five books, there's more Egyptian loanwords and phrases in the first five books than the rest of the Old Testament. So that kind of stuff is in there. And it's fascinating because Egypt was one of the first societies to have a full-functioning 26-character alphabet. So this guy was raised in the palace. He had access to all sorts of education. He was smart. So he fits the bill for the profile. Does that make sense? Anybody want to argue against Mosaic authorship or kind of talk about that more? Fallon so far? All right. So original audience. Who do you think the original audience was? Who was the first to receive the first five books? The Israelites. Which Israelites? That's a lot. There's a lot of different Israelites. Which generation? What? The ones coming out of Egypt. So again, this gets contested as well. But I would say if you read the text, it doesn't have to be that difficult. I just give you one. Let's see. I'll use two examples. Genesis 13:10. And Moses is talking about Zoar. So Zoar is just, it's a little bit south of the Dead Sea in the Jordan Valley. And so if you have been in Israel already, like, you don't have to know what Zoar's like. And he says it's well-watered like the delta in Egypt. Well, unless the people were coming out of Egypt and didn't know what the land of Canaan looked like yet, you wouldn't write something like that. Or another thing he does when he's talking to Jacob about Shechem. And he says, these are the words. He goes, Shechem is in Canaan. That'd be like me saying, hey, guys, you know where the arch is? It's downtown. I mean, that's ridiculous. You would already know. So if the people had already been in Canaan, you wouldn't see this kind of stuff in the text. So again, I'm going to just assume that this is either the first generation, the ones that were just rescued out, or the second generation. Remember, the first generation died off. They're out in the wilderness for 40 years. The second one was raised up, and now they're getting ready to take possession of the promised land, which I think is probably the most likely one. So we'll get into genre in just a little bit here. But does that make sense so far for the first five books, including Genesis 1 and 2? Moses authoring it, original audience, first, second, wilderness generation, and then the occasion they had just been rescued from Egypt, entered into the covenant at Mount Sinai with God. He takes them as his bride. Okay. We're cruising. Any questions so far?
Define genre.
Define genre. So that's a great question. I would define genre as the mode of literary device that the author has employed. So it would be genres, different genres. I'll give examples. It can be poetic, could be a genre. Prose can be a genre, which comes from the prosa oratio. So prose is ordinary language, usually used to tell stories, especially historical stories. So anything in between elevated. Does that help a little bit? So we don't know it was genre. So we're going to get into Genesis, and we'll talk about it. Because sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, well, Genesis 1 is genre. You might use the word myth. We can talk about that. If by myth we mean untrue, no thank you. If by myth we are telling stories that contain truth, I'm a little bit more okay with it, but not really. Again, I got a bunch of videos if you want them going through all that. But we'll talk about that just in a second. Because people also say, well, Genesis 1 is poetry. Have you heard that? Yeah, lots of times. But if you read Hebrew, it doesn't quite look anything like the poetry you see throughout the rest of the Hebrew scripture. So there's something different about Genesis 1. It's very unique. It's pretty neat. All right. Let's do this. Let's get into Genesis 1. And I want you just to listen. These are the first that received it. They're more of an oral culture, and they probably would have received it through the ears. So I'm going to recite Genesis 1 for you. And I just want you to tell me, what do you hear? What do you feel? What do you think the author was trying to get at? So can we do that together? So if you want to close your eyes, you can close your eyes. If you just want to sit, and just however you want to take it in and let it sort of wash over you. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. But the Spirit of God, Ruach Elohim, was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. The light he called day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made an expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, let the waters under the expanse gather into one place and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And the waters that were gathered together, he called seas, and the land that appeared, he called earth. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens, and let them be to give light upon the earth. Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the stars, the night, and he made the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the water swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. And God made the great sea creatures, and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters of the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creeping things, the beast of the earth. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and every creeping thing that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heaven, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over everything that moves on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heaven and over everything that moves on the earth. And behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and the bird of the heavens, everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And behold, God saw everything that he had made, and it was very good. Thus the heavens and the earth and all the hosts of them were finished. And on the seventh day, God finished the work that he had done on creation. And God rested on the seventh day from the work that he had done. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work he had done in creation. Okay, talk to me. What stood out? What'd you hear? What'd you feel? What do you think in terms of what's the author getting at?
I see a picture more than...
So you're seeing more of a picture. So leaning a little bit more towards something like that. Like he's really just doing word imagery. Wow, okay.
You have to keep in mind the fact that your audience is the first and second generation, wilderness generation. You showed them a schematic of something, they're probably not going to understand something, especially something as complex as creation itself. Okay. The best you can do is paint a picture.
All right, so what's your name?
David.
Did you hear what David said? He said you got to be cognizant of who your audience is. Pastor Bill, you know that as a pastor, right? You don't want you got to kind of hit where everybody is. So if you're getting like the schematic, creation is complex. I mean, holy cow, you could go into some details. We don't even understand all of it today. And you would really overwhelm them. So it seems like he's picturing more of a, getting more of a beautiful picture. And think about it. If he was doing a scientific taxonomy, how many times of arboreal or plant life, like plant yielding seed and fruit trees bearing fruit, which is their seed? Two kinds. Animals, maybe about three. Not exactly a helpful taxonomy if we were doing a like textbook from McGraw-Hill, right? So great point. Which might, again, might clue us into genre. Is this genre to give us some nitty-gritty details, or is the authorial intent, does the purpose lie elsewhere in what Moses wanted to do here? Did you hear what Bill just said, Pastor Bill? But there is technical information. Perfect. So even if the text leans more towards this, it is still talking about a historical reference of something that actually really happened, I'd argue. And because of that, some of this is still in there. And it should guide our science, because science done well, we're called as Christians to do science well. You can do Psalm 19, we can look at Romans 1. Science done well will accord with the Word of God. In fact, I'd argue that science is just now about, some in some places, especially in neuroscience, is catching up with God and what's revealed in Scripture. So yeah, go ahead. Yeah, very rhythmic. Just as you think about words and vibrations and all that, and then there's a rhythm, there's a pattern to this thing. This thing is incredibly well structured. Go ahead, Denise. So it's a question of whether it's word of mouth. Did Moses concoct this sort of out of...
I just didn't know if they've been going to some kind of a worship setting and they know that God created first the vast expanse and second this and third that and fourth. I just wondered if this is the first time they read it in Genesis. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they always knew. I mean, think about how much time Moses spent out in the desert with God, right? Face to face with a friend. So he's learning things, and God is revealing things. Again, that's why Moses, again, an inspired author. How much the Israelites of that generation knew, how much they had in contact with the Egyptian creation accounts, which I'm going to talk about next week quite a bit, how much they knew about the Mesopotamian accounts or the Canaanite accounts, because there's some overlaps. I will argue that the Hebrew one did not borrow from those, but it's almost an argument against them, saying, let me tell you who the one true God is. It's not the pantheon of Egypt. It's not the... So anyway, we'll get into some of that. So I don't know how much they know. There would have been an oral tradition that was passed down. How much they knew of that or didn't know that, how much did God reveal fresh and said, let me give you the correct rendering of this account. Because the really fascinating thing is, if you go and you look at the Egyptian, the Canaanite, the Mesopotamian creation accounts, they all start with water. It's not even there. If you go into the Mayans, if you go places that are globally separated, they couldn't have any sort of literary dependency on one another. They start with water. And so I would argue that some of these myths and these other things in other cultures are almost like a bastardization of the truth. They've just skewed things. And here God comes along and says, let me give you the proper interpretation of how creation actually happened. Sure. Yeah, so either passed down an oral tradition or God himself gave that revelation directly to Moses. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I think that's a, I think it's a great theory. Go ahead, David.
Well, I was going to say, we also get some indications that it probably was some oral tradition there solely because of the fact that even the Israelites in Egypt talked about their, you know, one day being rescued and finally going to the promised land. So there's some kind of indication of knowledge before Moses was talking to the wilderness crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the thing. It's like, okay, they knew something.
Right.
It just maybe not have been set down in stone. It was mm-hmm. probably, like you said, oral tradition.
Mm-hmm. Right. And he's using certain concepts, like the concept of image bearing is a thoroughly Egyptian concept. So, and I'll give some of the data from that if you go back and read the Egyptian literature that we have. Being made in the image of God was something that they knew for sure because they had just been tyrannized by the Pharaoh who was supposed to be in the image of God. And then God comes along and democratizes and says, you know what, I made everybody in the image of God, and not in the image of any God, not of Atum or Khan or anybody else, my own image. And because of that, you have the utmost dignity, value, and worth. And you have authority to rule and to have dominion, to be my kings and queens in this land who I've ordained to share my glory with, who I've crowned with glory, as Psalm 8 would say it. And so they're hearing all this, who've been enslaved, and saying, wait a minute, we're royalty? We're the ones? Yes. And only you rule on God's behalf, reflecting his character and his goodness and his benevolence towards creation. And that will change things. And that gives you some of your identity. Who am I as an image bearer? Let's start there. You want to talk about the problems we're having in our culture? It's because we've lost this image bearing and dignity value of worth of every single individual, male and female alike. So yeah, we'll get into some of that. But sorry, that gets me going. So more about the account. So you heard the rhythm and the pattern. This thing is structured. So what would you say if you had to guess on a genre? I mean, where are you guys landing so far? Like what kind of, if we use these two things, are we kind of, it's a little bit of, here we're in, there's certainly this, because we're talking about a historical account that actually happened. So it's going to make truth claims about the metaphysical reality of the world in which we live. And yet we've still got this beautiful artistry, this image that's being formed of the wonder that God went through in creating all this. What's that?
A tale?
So what do you mean by tale?
I was trying to think of like, well, it's told almost like a legend with like the physical like descriptions, but it's not the legend in the sense like the stuff didn't happen. Like for example, like I was trying to think of a villain like Robin Hood, for example. If Robin Hood, like if everything in that legend that was written was actually true, that's kind of what you get. But tale makes it sound, I guess tale has sort of a fictional connotation to it.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
There's a better genre you can put
on. No, that's great. But I think you're onto something because he's almost taking like a genre that would be legend or tale, but using that as the vehicle to actually deliver truth. So it just like there's poetic elements to it. So I'm going to say that I'm following guys like Moshe Kasuto, Jack Collins, who's here in St. Louis of Exalted, or Elevated Prose. So what that means is you're going to have poetic elements in it, in this thing. So think, why do you write poetry? Anybody ever written poetry? Yeah, what were you inspired to write poetry or what?
I just started writing poetry when I was in second grade.
Wow, okay.
And I remember when I first read the creation account, for me, what struck me the most was, wow, here's someone that creates something from nothing. This is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's what struck me.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yes. Which again, that why we'll talk about Genesis 1 in detail, because it's something that sets us apart from all the other accounts in the ancient Near East. It's like, well, where'd that come from if it wasn't inspired by God? Because nobody else had that. They were all pre-existent material. Yeah, so this exalted side, so yeah, I'll tell you, I tried to write poetry. You know when I wrote it? When I was in love. I'm not saying it was good poetry, but I wrote my wife like some poetry while, you know, it was her birthday and stuff, tried to impress her. Probably wasn't very good at all. Might have had the opposite effect. But you write it for occasions that call for it. Why? Because they're elevated occasions. That's why I call it elevated or exalted. This requires something more than your normal genre of prose or something else. Do you want to say something?
It reminds me, makes me think of an epilogue. It's the beginning.
Yes.
Just setting the stage,
yes. For all this. So it's this high occasion. And you write poetry because you want to move somebody emotionally. You want to convey information, but you want to draw them in. I believe that's what Moses is wanting to do here, what God is wanting to do, saying, I want you to be inspired. I want you to be in awe of everything God has done. How he did this with mere verbal fiat, just talking. Nothing opposed his will. Nothing resisted. It just happened so calmly and unfolded. And there's that. The earth was without form and it's void. And what does he do? He goes to work and he forms it and he fills it. And it's glorious. And it has this sort of rising up to it. And so there's this, yeah, elevated, exalted feel to it, which also means, though, that's going to warn us, because what happens in poetry?
Exaggeration.
There might be some exaggeration. There's going to be different literary forms. You might use some analogy. You might use some metaphor. You might use different literary techniques to paint a beautiful picture. It's all different brushstrokes in there to say, how can I bring about the wonder and the glory and the beauty of what God has done? What it will not let us do is say, well, that's poetry, so I don't know how true it is. No, you can use, first, you can use poetry to talk about true things. Look at Exodus 15 and the recount of everything that happened there. But at the same time, there's this prose. There's ordinary language. So in Hebrew, let's see if I got a thing that marks this. I don't have that slide. Oh, yeah, I do. So in Hebrew, there's something called the vayiktol chain. So it's basically the Hebrew vav. I know you can't look at that. So the Hebrew vav looks like this, bloop, plus the imperfect verb tense. Now, what this grammatical feature is, it's the backbone of Hebrew prose narrative. So if you're telling a story, this is of something that actually happened, and I'm relaying those events to you, you would use this sort of genre of prose. You can see it in your Bible. It's that and word. That's how we translate it. It can also be an adversative, but it's that and. So, and then this happened, and then that happened. Somebody tells stories in English, and then that. So that is happening all throughout this account, which also says that you can't toss this thing out and say it's not about a true event. Absolutely it is. So it's combining these two genres together. Does that make sense? That's why I say it doesn't look anything like some of the other poetry. It doesn't look quite like prose. It's this its own unique animal all in itself. And that's going to how to guide how we read it. It's making truth claims about the world in which we live and how this all happened. And yet it's going to use some beautiful imagery. And we have to figure out, okay, so how have the details been arranged? If so, what was the author doing there? And what are the literary clues to make our case? We can't just say, well, I don't know if that fits with so-and-so. We've got to actually make a case for this kind of stuff. So that's where we are headed with that. And let me tell you about this. Did you feel it slow down anywhere? Do you feel that rhythm and that cadence slow down anywhere?
At the end of the day.
At the end of the day, it slows down.
When you finally got the man.
And I slowed it down a little bit. And I talk fast. You can tell me to slow down. But so God created man in his own image. After that, that vayiktol chain stops. So in the Hebrew language, that slows things down. And it's God and Moses saying, let me draw your attention now to this. And don't go past it too quickly. Take it all in. God created man in his own image. Male and female, he created them. You've got to know that about yourself as being one who's in the image of God. That's what they'll flesh it out because it's so important for identity for today. And so it slows down and it kind of picks back up a little bit. So this thing is some of the poetic features of it. It's we already said it's extremely broad stroke. It's highly patterned. Even at numericals. Anybody heard about the numerical stuff of it? It uses a lot of sevens. It uses a lot of tens. So even in the first verse, seven in Hebrew, number of completion. Six is a number of being incomplete. Thus the mark of the beast, 666. One who's incomplete, complete, but a parody of the kingdom of God. Let who can calculate, calculate. I don't want to get in Revelation, but that gets really interesting, and it's related to the seven. So anyway, so we get into the seven, the number of being complete, three, the number of emphasis. So that first line is seven words, not in your English, but in your Hebrew. So we'll go, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha'aretz, et ha'shamayim v'et ha'aretz. So Bereshit, in the beginning, bara, created, Elohim, God, marker of direct object, the et, then the hashamayim, the heavens, and then another va'et, a direct marker, a marker of direct object, and then ha'aret, seven words. Number of complete. This is how God did all this. Second verse, guess how many words are in that? 14, 2 times 7. So you have all these things that are multiples or derivatives of seven. The verbs in the first verse, so if you look at Elohim there, throughout the account in this section is used 35 times. Again, a multiple of seven, 7 times 5. If you look at earth and water, again, the two biggest themes of that, or then the seas, those are repeated each 21 times in the account. Again, divisible by 7. So this thing is highly patterned. If you look at Vayomer Elohim, and God said. So that occurs 10 times, which the rabbis picked up on that because this is an act of creation. God's 10 sayings, God's 10 utterance. You get in the 10 commandments. How many times? 10? God's 10 utterance. It's a recreation. He's recreating through Israel. So it's an act of recreation. But if you look at it, it's broken out that 10, number of completeness also in Hebrew, is the first of them, the let God said, 7, and then 3. 3, the number of emphasis. The 3 comes in when he says, and let us make man. And God blessed them and said to them, so he blessed them, and behold, God said, I have given you. So it's all God's care for man, saying this is a God who cares. That's where the emphasis is. This is a God who cares. Unlike the other accounts where the gods have to create in order they can be served and be fed, here's a God who feeds. Here's a God who gives. He has nothing. He needs nothing from us. He's utterly transcendent, stands outside space and time, not dependent upon it in any way, not identified with any of the features. Nothing in this account gets its normal Hebrew name. The sun and the moon, the lesser light and the greater light, probably because the sun and the moon were divinized in Egypt and the other accounts. Here, they don't even get their normal names, and they're relegated to day 4 on that. So first there's light, and then we have the suns being formed and fashioned to their normal cycles and everything else. So this count is some of this elevated prose. So I'm going to say that's the genre. That's going to guide our reading going forward. And then next week we'll pick up with verse 1:1 and everything that's in that, and we'll move from there. So hope I didn't like bore you with this stuff. I just wanted to let you know how I'm reading the text and getting at things. Any questions so far? Because we're right on the nose. Sound like it'd be all right? All right. And it's going to get more fun. Trust me, it's going to get lots of fun, because especially when you get into what he wants for us in relationships and the couples. We'll talk about the relationship of Genesis 1 and 2 and how I'm going to argue that they're complementary based on the chiastic structure of Genesis 2:4, where Moses is like, hello, I've told you how to read these things. They're not two different accounts. So we'll talk about that being the expansion of the events of day 6, all that kind of good stuff. So we got lots of stuff to cover.